It is Monday, August the 27th. This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you here. Coming up, Pope Francis trying to keep children and others safe from sex abuse.
Every child and every vulnerable person in any way associated with any Catholic Church institution or agency will always be safe.
Renowned war hero and longtime U.S. Senator John McCain has died.
I've had the good fortune to spend 60 years in service to this wondrous land.
Also ahead, the amazing sounds of a glass harpist, plus a little something from the world of music. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. The Vatican's retired ambassador to the United States has penned a letter accusing senior Vatican officials of knowing the former Archbishop of Washington, ex-Cardinal Theodore McCarrick, regularly engaged in sexual relations with seminarians. AP's Mike Hempen is following the story.
The 11-page letter is attributed to Archbishop Carlo Maria Vigano, who urges Pope Francis to resign over the issue. The letter says Vatican leaders were aware of McCarrick inviting seminarians into his bed as far back as 2000, but still promoted him to cardinal. The letter, published by the National Catholic Register and LifeSite News, also accuses Francis of initially rehabilitating McCarrick, despite being told about his pension for young seminarians in 2013. Francis accepted McCarrick's resignation as cardinal last month. I'm Mike Hempen.
Pope Francis said Sunday on his return flight to Rome from a 32-hour visit to Ireland he would not respond to that 11-page letter by the Archbishop. The Pope told reporters such a statement regarding McCarrick and the Pope's knowledge of allegations against the former cardinal were, in his words, "They speak for themselves." While in Ireland, the Pope met with survivors of sexual abuse by priests. Paul Redman was among those who met with Francis. He heads a group of homes designed as refuge for people who have been sexually abused.
He came back at the end and apologized to all of us for what had happened to us. And the thing that really shocked us all was when he was talking to survivors about cover-up and corruption in Rome itself. He literally referred to these people as caca. And his translator again was kind of shocked and asked the Pope to clarify. And the Pope literally did some hand gestures and said, caca, they're filth in the toilet.
Publicly, while in Ireland, Pope Francis begged God for forgiveness with regard to the accusations presented by the former Vatican ambassador to Washington. VOA's Victor Beatty asked Brian Lucas, a Catholic priest and national director of Catholic Mission in Australia, how serious is all of this for the Catholic Church?
Look, I think we're always in a time of crisis right through history. There's been various challenges that the Church faces because the Church exists in the world that is a broken, fragile world, and people within the Church themselves are broken and fragile. But we have to face this particular crisis with real conviction and say two things are necessary. The first is that every child and every vulnerable person in any way associated with any Catholic Church institution or agency will always be safe. So that's what we might call the prevention and recognition of areas of risk and to deal with that. By and large around the world, that is well implemented. The second is to look historically at those people who in the past, and in Australia, for example, our issues go back now more than 30 years, some 40, some 50 years, to ensure that all of those people who, in whatever way, have been hurt by the behaviour of people associated with the Church, that they are dealt with justly and compassionately.
What do you make of the 11-page statement by Archbishop Carlo Maria Vigano?
I don't know the detail and haven't had the opportunity to read all of that detail. Obviously, he has a point of view. He's obviously very concerned that whatever he did was not given the attention that he believes it deserves. And that will need to be worked through in his relationship with the relevant Vatican officials to get to the bottom of what he said, when he said it in the past, who was supposed to do something about the advice that he gave, and why, according to his view of the matter, that hasn't given him the results that he expected.
The Archbishop has called for the Pope to set an example and resign along with all of the others implicated.
Well, I'm not sure whether that's the right response to the particular allegations. And sometimes resigning is to walk away from a problem. Sometimes it's a matter of confronting the problem. And Pope Francis seems to be sending a very clear message from what he said in Ireland, a very clear message that he is committed both to ensure children are safe, as I said, as the first issue, but to ensure that people who have been hurt in the church are dealt with in the proper way.
What is the reaction, do you think, among the faithful in the Catholic Church to these allegations?
I think the people in the church, and in Australia I can speak from the personal experience, have had many, many instances of very intense media scrutiny. For some of them, yes, they feel disillusioned, they feel hurt, they feel upset. For others, they realise the frailty and fragility of what happens within the life of the church, and they come together in a commitment to ensure that these problems don't exist in the future and that people are dealt with properly.
Do you anticipate a new era of transparency, or at least an effort to engage in a transparent situation?
That's certainly been the situation, again, speaking from the Australian context. The Australian bishops first began to deal with these issues in November 1987, when there was a presentation to their plenary meeting. They then put in place protocols. There have been various inquiries. There have been two royal commissions, one about 20 years ago, a big government inquiry that put in place some very good reforms for the community generally about how to deal with children at risk and to deal with these allegations. And then in more recent years, finishing about a year ago, we had a five-year inquiry, another royal commission, where the church and secular organisations and other Christian churches and other non-Christian religious groups were very much put under the microscope for what had happened. What became very clear from that royal commission was that the Australian bishops, having addressed the problem in 1987, the incidence of offending plummeted. So most of our difficulties and problems and the things that need to be addressed for the sake of people who are hurting now go back into the 1970s and 80s.
Brian Lucas, a Catholic priest and national director of Catholic Mission, which is the name used in Australia for the Pontifical Mission Societies. He was speaking with VOA's Victor Beatty. This is VOA.
VOA Africa has built a successful, effective social media strategy through Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, and other digital platforms. We are responding to our audience on the African continent and in the global diaspora. We believe in the power of connection and interaction to bring you news that is comprehensive, accurate, and objective. We see the changes in technology as an opportunity to engage with our audiences about the issues that affect them. At VOA Africa, we don't just report the news, we help shape the conversation on the continent. VOA, your trusted source for news and information.
This is VOA International Edition. U.S. Senator John McCain, an internationally renowned Vietnam War hero who served for 30 years in the U.S. Senate, has died due to complications stemming from brain cancer. His family was by his side. The 81-year-old McCain was part of many of the three decades' most significant political moments in the U.S. He was well known for working with members of the opposition, the Democratic Party, to tackle issues such as immigration, campaign finance reform, and climate change. And some of his colleagues in the Democratic Party were also some of his best friends. They include the late Massachusetts Senator Ted Kennedy, former Connecticut Senator Joe Lieberman, and former Vice President and Delaware Senator Joe Biden. We get more now on the death of John McCain from AP's Sagar Magani.
I've had the good fortune to spend 60 years in service to this wondrous land.
As a Navy fighter pilot, McCain was shot down over Vietnam, surviving 5 years in captivity. Decades later, Donald Trump mocked McCain's status.
He's a war hero because he was captured. I like people that weren't captured, okay? I hate to tell you.
The two bickered throughout the campaign. McCain had already waged his own presidential bids. Riding the Straight Talk Express to the GOP nomination in 2008 before losing to fellow Senator Barack Obama.
The American people have spoken. and they have spoken clearly.
McCain continued speaking.
The Senate Armed Services Committee meets this morning.
As a powerful committee chair, jabbing the Obama administration over its Islamic State strategy.
When you're not winning in war, you are losing.
In the summer of 2017, McCain was diagnosed with the same type of aggressive brain cancer that had killed Senator Ted Kennedy. Weeks after brain surgery, he was back on the Senate floor in late July.
Mr. McCain, I...
Colleagues applauded before listening to him blast a growing partisan divide.
We're getting nothing done, my friends. We're getting nothing done.
McCain's plea that day was that they remember the honor of working together to serve the American people.
Mr. President, I yield the floor.
Sagar Meghani, Washington.
And as we just heard, John McCain was captured by the North Vietnamese. That was in 1967, and he endured more than 5 years of torture and deprivation as a prisoner of war. VOA Asia's Ira Melman spoke via Skype with Alvin Townley, the author of the book Defiant. In the book, Townley describes his visit to the prison, nicknamed the Hanoi Hilton, where McCain and his fellow prisoners were incarcerated.
The goal of the North Vietnamese was to get intelligence and propaganda statements from these POWs. And for a while, they would have long interrogation sessions and raise their voice and get a little rough with the POWs. And at some point, though, we don't know exactly what happened, but the government decided they needed more propaganda, more statements and more intelligence more quickly. And so the North Vietnamese began really putting the American prisoners through torture, and they used ropes and other means of coercing American POWs to talk and to sign confessions, and they would break these POWs who had such a strong resolve not to break. And this was these are all fighter pilots, like John McCain. He's a fighter pilot, and fighter pilots hate to lose, and they are control freaks, and they love to be in control of their world. And all of a sudden, in prison, they found they were in control of almost nothing. But one of the last things they could control was what came out of their mouth. And so, for them to record a confession or give up intelligence and lose control of what they said, that was kind of the ultimate humiliation for those guys. And when John McCain was shot down and captured, quickly the North Vietnamese realized that he was the son of the commander of the Pacific Forces. So his father was an admiral. And they thought that, well, they might win some PR points by sending home the admiral's son. And so they offered John McCain the chance to go home early. He refused. And then they really tried to put pressure on him. And really use some rough means to try and get him to go home, but he would not go home despite being in terrible physical condition. I think certainly he probably could have made the argument that if he didn't go home, he might die from his injuries, but he still stuck it out. And so, I think regardless of politics or anything else, the POWs and members of the military community have always really respected John McCain for that action.
What led, in your mind anyway, and from your investigation and from your research, from that point where there probably should have been and probably have been high levels of anger among those who were being in prison, to the time that McCain then decided he wanted some kind of rapprochement, wanted some kind of reconciliation between Vietnam and the United States?
It was about a little over 10 years before John McCain went back to Vietnam, but he went back in 1985, I believe. And that was a decade before we restored official relations with Vietnam. And I think that he saw a country that needed American help. I think strategically he saw a country on the border of China that needed to we should be allied with. But I think he saw a chance for the United States to help Vietnam. I think he certainly saw a lot of destruction and devastation over that country when he was a prisoner there. And he realized that it was time to move on. John McCain has always been really good about putting bad things in the past and moving forward, politically or with the war. And so I think he was one of the leaders. And I think the men that were POWs in Hanoi had a unique perspective and I think a unique ability to help reconcile our two countries. And I think they've done a wonderful job of that. And I think it's been beneficial for the United States and certainly from what I've seen there on the ground, the people of Hanoi as well.
Was McCain the driving force between this, or were a lot of other people involved as well?
John McCain's a leader and has been a leader in everything he's done. He has a vision, he has an idea, and he has an amazing ability to be persistent and see his vision played out. So I think he was always a driver in this. I think President Clinton saw the value there, and subsequently President Bush and Obama, I think, have continued to restore our relationships with Vietnam, which both in trade and security, I think has been a smart thing and a positive development.
Alvin Townley is the author of the book Defiant. He was speaking with VOA Asia's Ira Melman. Musician Jamie Turner chose an unconventional career path by becoming a glass harpist. See, he plays music with drinking glasses filled with water. VOA's Deborah Block watched Turner play the glass harp in Alexandria, Virginia, where people seemed to be awestruck by the sounds he created.
Glass harpist Jamie Turner spreads his music to visitors in Alexandria, Virginia, with this popular classical tune, Ode to Joy by Beethoven. Turner has been showcasing his music here for more than 25 years. A lot of tourists come to visit this historic town outside Washington, many from overseas.
I've never heard something like this before. I think it's fantastic.
I think it's like a really different way to play music, and it seems difficult to do it and to remember like which cup sounds which way.
Turner, who is 78 years old, began playing the glass harp 50 years ago. Although he also plays other instruments, the glass harp is his passion.
The instrument that really caught my imagination was the sound of glass when I heard my dad playing a glass around the dining room table when I was 6 years old.
Turner sets up 60 ordinary stemmed glasses on a soundboard, anchored with rubber bands, which keeps them from breaking. He tunes each glass to a different pitch by filling them with distilled water. As Turner rubs his dampened fingers around the rims, the smaller bowls produce higher pitches, while the larger ones resonate deeper tones.
The more water is in the glass, the lower the pitch.
Some visitors enjoyed the opportunity to play the biggest glasses.
I didn't know glass was actually like an instrument. I didn't know it made that much sound.
The glass harp was popular in the 1700s, when classical composers like Mozart wrote music specifically for the instrument. Turner plays all kinds of music. Including this popular Chinese tune.
Very amazing.
The glass harpist has been able to make a living as a performer and has even played with top U.S. orchestras. But with so few people playing the glass harp, Turner is hoping the next generation will keep the instrument alive.
I think it's gaining in popularity. A lot of people have seen me on YouTube, and I'm very pleased that it will continue. People can't help but smile when they hear it.
Deborah Block, VOA News, Alexandria, Virginia.
It is pretty amazing. I've been out to see Turner play. Really remarkable. Hey, listen, still ahead on our program, the sounds of earth, wind, and fire. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
According to the recently released State of the Climate Report, annual average air temperatures in the Arctic are increasing at twice the rate than the rest of the world. Researchers at the University of California, Berkeley, and Berkeley Labs have released a new study that indicates that with increasing Arctic temperatures, vegetation growth is booming in areas that were once thought too frigid to support plant life. The study shows that 16% of Arctic land, where it was once too cold for plant growth in 1982, now sustains vegetation. Study first author Trevor Keenan from Berkeley Labs says that while augmented vegetation growth, with its increased ability to absorb carbon dioxide, may sound like good news, it represents a major disruption to the delicate balance of the cold ecosystem. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is VOA's International Edition. Very super to have you with us today. Hey, you want to hear something super? Stay tuned. There's some music straight ahead. Earth, Wind & Fire is an American band that spans the musical genres of R&B, soul, funk, jazz, disco, pop rock, Latin, and Afropop. They have been described as one of the most innovative and commercially successful bands of all time. Earth, Wind & Fire was founded in Chicago by Maurice White in 1970, having grown out of a previous band known as the Salty Peppers. Two of their songs, Earth, Wind & Fire that is, have made it into the Grammy Hall of Fame. That's The Way of the World in 2004, and the song we're listening to, Shining Star, in 2007. Earth, Wind & Fire has won 4 American Music Awards out of 12 nominations altogether. They also have been inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame and the Vocal Group Hall of Fame, received a star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame, and sold more than 90 million records, making them one of the world's best-selling bands of all time. Among their many hits is After the Love Is Gone, featuring Maurice White's baritone sound. Members of Earth, Wind & Fire were inducted into the Songwriters Hall of Fame: Maurice White, Philip Bailey, Verdeen White, Larry Dunn, and Al McKay. Earth, Wind & Fire was also the first African-American act to sell out Madison Square Garden in New York, and they've won 6 Grammys with a sum of 17 nominations. On that list, likely, is what many consider their signature song, September. You know, I defy you to sit still listening to that song. I mean, you got to be tapping something, moving your ears, whatever you do. Yeah, ears. People flap their ears. It's amazing. Anyway, thanks for tuning in today to the Voice of America on International Editions of the program. Good to have you here. Latest world news is straight ahead, so we hope you'll stay tuned. For our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, John Ellison, I'm all excited. The music, it gets me going. I'm Steve Norman. We're all in Washington, hoping you have a super Monday. Here's Earth, Wind & Fire.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The overarching strategy of the United States towards Russia is to deter Russia from confrontation by raising the costs of its aggression. This includes strengthening the military, economic, and political foundations of American power. Our Russia policy proceeds from the recognition that, to be effective, U.S. diplomacy must be backed by military power, said Assistant Secretary for European and Eurasian Affairs Wes Mitchell in congressional testimony. To that end, we have reversed years of cuts to the defense budget, begun the process of recapitalizing the U.S. nuclear arsenal, requested close to $11 billion for the European Deterrence Initiative, and worked within NATO to bring about more than $40 billion in new European defense spending. Through diplomatic expulsions and targeted sanctions, the U.S. has worked in close coordination with European allies to degrade Russian President Vladimir Putin's ability to conduct aggression by imposing costs on the Russian state, as well as on the oligarchs close to Putin who helped to sustain the state. Even as the U.S. has imposed unprecedented penalties for Russian aggression, said Dr. Mitchell, we have been clear that the door to dialogue is open. In Syria, Dr. Mitchell said, we created de-escalation channels to avoid collisions between our forces. In Ukraine, we have maintained an effort under Ambassador Kurt Volker to provide the means by which Russia can live up to its commitments under the Minsk agreements. But in all these areas, it is up to Russia to take the next step. The U.S. has bolstered frontline states in Europe. In Ukraine and Georgia, said Assistant Secretary Mitchell, we lifted restrictions on the acquisition of defensive weapons. In the Balkans, we have played a hands-on role in resolving the Greece-Macedonia name dispute and engaging with Serbia and Kosovo to propel the EU-led dialogue. From the Caucasus to Central Europe, we are promoting energy diversification, fighting corruption, and competing for hearts and minds. Russia foments and funds both sides of controversial causes in an effort to destabilize societies and governments. Countering such threats in both its overt and covert forms is among the highest priorities of the U.S. government and our NATO allies. The United States is committed to countering Russian aggression and malign activities. At the same time, the door to dialogue is open. Our respective national security advisors have met in Geneva. Should Russia choose to take steps toward a constructive path.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.